On the line right now, we've got joining us Tony Gosling from Bristol and from thisweek.org and BCFM in Bristol. Investigative journalist, former BBC journalist and Bilderberger exposer. Plus he's into his history as well with interest involving social justice. So let's welcome along Tony Gosling on the line. How are you doing, Tony?
Yeah, nice to hear from you.
And you, it's great to have you on the show. I don't know if you heard that, Tony, but I'd like to get, you know, your bit of a take on that as well. Are we really building up to a confrontational situation in Ukraine at this very moment?
Well, I think we're in a situation where we're living in the world now where actually armies, tanks, obviously they are around, but the main force behind much of the changes that we're seeing in the world is the media. We're living in a world where some parts of the world think one thing, other parts of the world think another thing, because their understanding of what's going on around them is controlled by the mainstream press, which is now in fewer and fewer hands. It's been consolidated into very few people's hands. Really, I mean, it sounds like a dreadful thing to say, but a handful of people.
Yeah,
now
they say about
control
six.
What we see and hear.
Yeah.
So if you want, each of those is almost like a satellite hanging over the world, beaming down a certain view of things. I mean, for example, we've had a massive story over the last month or so about various kids, almost, it seems, by, if you read the press, being kidnapped and sent over to Syria, you know, by, or at least not actually kidnapped, but kind of coaxed over there, and you know, the implication here is that there is this kind of latent wish for particularly children in Islamic families to turn into terrorists and this kind of thing. And we find out, I mean, I don't know if you've come across this story, but this is one of the most amazing for me the last few days, that the chap from Turkey who was meeting them and helping them to get to Syria through Turkey, remembering, of course, that Turkey's a NATO country.
Yeah.
And it turns out that this guy's working for the Canadian Secret Service.
Oh, God.
That was broadcast on Turkish TV, and it's made a little bit of press in Canada. I'm not sure about the broadcast press, but it's not been heard at all here in Britain. And this is about British kids. And yet the British press is not interested that one of our fellow NATO countries, Canada, in fact, which is largely controlled by through the British Crown still, with the governor, actually the Queen a few years ago, suspended Parliament in Canada, if you remember.
That's right, yeah.
And so, you know, we've got a situation where our own supposed allies and people under our control are stealing our kids, bringing them over to fight as so-called jihadis over in Syria. Now, you know, it's pretty obvious to me. I don't know about the rest of the population. Anyone that watches the BBC will probably be none the wiser, but the whole phenomenon of ISIS is an entirely new front which has been opened, largely a media front, that is to get the viewers and listeners in Britain and in the Western world behind the idea that ISIS is somehow some kind of Islamic entity. What they don't tell you, of course, is most of the Islamic terror groups, if not all of them, were actually created by our own intelligence service, MI6 and the CIA, through Operation Cyclone in the 1980s and 1990s, in order to fight the Russians in Afghanistan and then all over the world, including places like Bosnia. Our intelligence services are behind the creation of ISIS. They are supplying ISIS. They're also supplying the propaganda that goes with it. That is to say, watch out for what used to be Reds Under the Bed, didn't it, here in Britain too. So that's what I think this is really all about, is about basically bamboozling, conning the British public and others in the Western world through control of the press and through using the press Goebbels style to literally make big lies. Remember, Hitler had this big lie. You tell a big enough lie, people will believe it.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on right now here with the BBC and other big networks here in Britain. And I wouldn't say everyone working with the BBC is in on this. They're not. Quite often you see with these particular stories, somebody completely new will appear on the screen, a reporter, and you look at them and you think,
Where they come from?
Where's this person from? I've never heard of them before. It's not Jeremy Bowen talking about the Middle East whatever. There is a whole military intelligence operation running through the mainstream press right now, planting false stories and also making sure that we think what we're supposed to think without any kind of questioning or balance of the official military intelligence story.
Yeah, I quite agree. You had quite a revelation on Friday, didn't you, with one of your own presenters at BCFM.
That's right, it's Bristol Community FM, yeah. It was the guy actually that's on the show after me, Arabian Nights. He's originally Sudanese. And we quite often have a little chit-chat in between the handover whilst the news is going out and that sort of thing. And the other day he was saying, Mohammed Anwazi story, you know, this awful term used, Jihadi John, to describe him in The Sun and all other sorts of hideous right-wing press. So he said, I had a similar experience a few years ago. So I said, all right, okay, next week, come in a bit early and we'll have a chat to you about it. And he gave us a good 10 minutes explaining how he was basically intimidated by somebody from MI5 who'd drawn him in through a what looked like kind of spurious legal CID criminal, you know, basically police charge. The police were investigating something separate but related to him, something to do with the flat that he was living in, and then they said to him, look, well, if you want some money and you want help getting asylum, and we'll make sure everything works out for you if you start working for us and give us information on your own community. And he quite wonderfully told him to get lost, and he said, look, I've just come from Sudan, where we were happy to deal there with military intelligence over in Sudan, and now you're telling me you want me to spy on my own community here in Britain. So go just take a running jump,
just blatantly like that. I mean, we've seen similar stories, haven't we, that these people involved in the terrorism aspect, we can look back at the 7/7 bombings, we're even more recently to the Woolwich beheading, the attempted beheading that happened there, that these guys involved in this had some connection to MI5 and the security services.
Well, the big joke, if you can call it that, with Anwazi, of course, was he was actually quite a peace-loving guy and very much against things like 7/7 and 9/11 until, it seems, I mean, it's difficult to know whether this is just theatre or, you know, a scripted kind of story, or whether there's, you know, how much reality there is to it. But it seems that through interacting with the security services in this country, he became a kind of crazed killer. Now, as far as I'm concerned, there is no accountability whatever going on with MI5 and MI6. These people are basically very close to the royal family, and in a similar kind of way, you can't get rid of them. They're above the law. I mean, we've seen this, of course, with the child sexual abuse scandals. I don't know how much you had a look at last week about the report that came out about the Cyril Smith inquiry the IPCC are now doing. But it's quite clear a prominent person close to the royal family, close to the top of the BBC, close to positions of power, if they were mentioned in any kind of statement by someone who'd been abused, basically it was getting the Tippex out and basically Tippexing over anybody who was rich and powerful. Now, to me, this is possibly even more serious a criminal offence than the offence that took place in the first place, which is people who are in public office, and I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can get these people. I mean, they would, you know, you can do them under malfeasance, you know, deliberate misconduct in public office. You can do them under malicious falsehood. There's a whole range of criminal offences that cover these, and yet it does look as if, doesn't it, that we're living in this kind of feudal system with a handful of extremely powerful, rich people at the top that can just do what they want and totally ignore the law.
You tweeted out a good story today that goes back to the 70s involving the South African intelligence with the blackmail allegation of Cyril Smith's involvement in sexual abuse of boys, which helped him escape justice in the mid-1970s. What was surrounding that, Tony?
Well, that was actually wasn't me. It was the Independent, and I think this is the way I operate. Anyway, I won't follow one particular newspaper or another particular newspaper. In fact, even The Sun came out with quite an interesting story the other day, which I thought was important, which is to do with a couple who were living in their car, but then were forced by bailiffs to sell the car they were living in.
Oh, you're joking.
This kind of thing. So there is, even in The Sun, I hate to say it, but I have to, the Daily Mail, all sorts of, awful stuff in there. But they do also have some good stuff too. In every outlet, the BBC as well, has something good about them. So the idea of following only one or two or three newspapers or news outlets is actually, for me, a complete waste of time. You've got to have a little bit of everything. And this is that story you were mentioning there, was in today's Independent. I think the thing for me is, every newspaper that I buy, I will see maybe one or two really important stories. The rest of it, you know, you can kind of forget about, and it sort of fades into the background. And that to me is what would be nice to see, is some kind of digest of all of that stuff, because I have to trawl through it all.
Yeah.
But that's what we generally do when we do our radio show, which, by the way, it's not thisweek.org, it's thisweek.org.uk.
Oh, sorry.
Every Friday evening, as everyone's driving home here in Bristol, they can get it. And sometimes when they get home, I've had people say to me, I have to sit on the driver and listen to the end of the show.
It's
so
incredible.
Well worth listening to.
Yeah, it is. I can vouch for that, because I dip in and out on most weeks on listening to your shows, and they are. The guy who co-presents with you, is it Mark?
Martin Summers. Yeah,
Martin Summers
is an interesting character.
He is.
He was involved actually over in Bosnia as part of the international aid effort, but then he was also working for CAFOD, the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development.
Right.
And involved in some rather shady, you should get him on sometime to talk about that, dodgy dealing to do with cash in his back pocket as well, under the cover of CAFOD. But he was involved in the whole Yugoslavia, which is, you know, is a fascinating way to compare what's happened in Ukraine with what happened in Yugoslavia, because, you know, a very similar kind of situation where there were all sorts of different ethnic religious groups in the old former Yugoslavia held together by Tito, and it was a communist country, Yugoslavia, but independent of the Soviet Union, which was, you know, it's quite amazing. People, you know, to go back and think of something that wasn't actually part of the Soviet bloc, but allied with it, but independent from it, you know, so it was a very unique area, Yugoslavia. Of course, in the Second World War, absolutely amazing amounts of partisan activity. I mean, the Germans, Nazis held it, but only very, very
just about. Yeah.
Because there were, if a Nazi convoy was to go through the interior of Yugoslavia, chances are it would be ambushed, sabotaged or whatever. And so that was why Tito managed to hold the place together, because the place was held together after World War II.
Right.
But if you look at what happened in Yugoslavia, the West supported the breakaway, sort of mini countries that were part of Yugoslavia, and funnily enough, they're not doing that, are they, with the east of Ukraine, even though east of Ukraine wants to, they're not doing that up in Scotland, you know, with the Scots that seem to want to break away just about nearly almost, and the same, of course, in Spain, with Catalonia wanting to break away from Madrid. You've got the similar situation actually in Venice in a vote, where the Venetians said, we want to have nothing to do with Italy. Now, this is a crisis brought about through the people who joined the Euro, the European Central Bank.
Yeah.
I mean, Margaret Thatcher, bless her, years ago, tried to stop Britain joining the exchange rate mechanism, which eventually kicked us out anyway. But, you know, the idea, if you want to join a European currency, you can kiss goodbye to your national sovereignty, because the people that control the money control the country.
Yeah.
They control the treasury, and they control the politics of the country through the purse strings.
Exactly. But with the Ukraine situation, we see that recently we're sending some, putting quote, specialists from the armed forces out there. I think it was about 70 specialists or something. With the coup d'etat, that I call it coup d'etat, but the US-led coup d'etat, how much involvement do you think our secret services are having at this very moment in the Ukraine?
It's quite clearly part of the NATO strategy. But look, I mean, I don't actually think, this is just through my limited knowledge of the British Army and the armed forces here, I don't think that there's a really much of a stomach from the British Army's point of view of getting involved in Ukraine, because they can see it's playing politics. They can also see that this is really a US-led concept. What they're trying to do is they're trying to split off Russia from Europe, and they've been trying to do that right since the end of the Second World War, when people like General Patton wanted to use the German divisions that were still left at the end of the war, and the British, along with the Americans, to attack and invade Russia at the end of the Second World War. In 1945, Patton died in a car crash, I think, not long after that. But I mean, he wanted it, and I think they still want it today. The US has been using its influence through the Bilderberg conferences, which I've been following, as you mentioned at the start, over the years, in order to try and split Europe from Russia, because you know, this is all very far away from America. If anything kicks off, it doesn't affect the Americans directly, and it's all about power, you know. And also, of course, the Nazis, lots of them went over on Operation Paperclip to the US after the Second World War, so there's been a kind of clandestine Nazi underground, with the Dulles brothers after the war being behind it and running the CIA and the State Department, being actually behind this kind of Nazi underground that's been in the US ever since. And they are doing everything they can to coerce Western Europe into splitting off from Eastern Europe and Russia, and well, Russia particularly, obviously Eastern Europe's become part of the EU, a lot of it. So that's actually, I think, really what's going on here, and they're trying to harden the sides. That's just why I describe is, you know, you get the people to sort of choose a side, and then you start hardening those sides by having war and conflict, and you have to choose a side. You know, so this is the way, I think, this is sort of divide and rule tactic that's going on. And of course, we desperately need trade with Russia in order to keep the European economy going. I mean, look at Greece, look at Italy, look at Spain. I mean, look at the British economy is in this sort of, the figures look good, but on the ground, it's in a complete doldrums. It's a total mess, and the people are getting paid next to nothing to work all the hours God sends.
Yeah, can you see the EU being more and more isolated over this internationally?
Well, I'm not so sure about that, because the EU will only ever be isolated. The thing is, EU and the US is really part of the same thing. United States of America, and the same big corporations and banks control most of the big industrialists and the political parties right across Europe and the United States. Now, I would say what's happening in Greece is really interesting, in that they've started to split away. They've got enormous, great Mediterranean frontage, and the idea that they might be sort of looking over to Russia and saying, well, hang on, you know, what about forming some kind of economic alliance so that we can split away from the euro?
Well, we can see in Cyprus, can't we, that the offers there from the Cypriot government with lending land to bases, two naval bases and an air force base in Cyprus to the Russians.
Because of what's happened in Ukraine. All this talk about the annexation of Crimea is just, I mean, again, it's just pure Goebbels propaganda, because it wasn't annexed at all. You know, this is a traditional Russian speaking area. They're much closer to the Russians, always have been, and you know, this sort of talk, it, you know, the idea that you're kind of projecting these kind of the things that the Nazis did, like to Czechoslovakia, etc., before World War II, onto what the Russians are doing with Donetsk, Lugansk, etc., is really, you know, it's just propaganda, pure propaganda. And I do tear my hair out sometimes watching this stuff, but you've got to watch it, because, you know, even however ridiculous it comes across as to me, you know, I really show both sides when we do our radio stuff. What I try and do is show, well, they're saying, one person's saying this and the other person's saying this. What's missing from the mainstream media is the counterpoint of view. It's just trotted out as if it's a fact. I mean, the most amazing thing over the last few months for me was the murder of Boris Nemtsov in Moscow a few weeks ago. It was constantly trotted out that this guy is the opposition leader, in the Western press, again and again and again, literally Goebbels style, day after day, hour after hour. Now, Boris Nemtsov's got no influence whatsoever in the Duma in Moscow. He's a has-been, a total has-been. He was part of a totally corrupt Yeltsin government, which did everything it could to sell off, flog off cheap to the oligarchs all the Russian infrastructure that had been built up over decades by the state. Things like your sort of car plants, all this kind of thing, were just flogged off cheap under him. And, you know, God rest his soul, you know, I've got nothing against the guy, but he was not the, as they say, opposition leader.
No.
The opposition in Russia, I think they've got about 15-20% is the communists. Zyuganov and the Communist Party is still the main opposition to Putin. And so this is just a way of conning people and lying to people. And I find it absolutely despicable that sort of language is not challenged anywhere really nowadays in the London-based mainstream press.
Yeah, like you say, I remember listening to a show of yours not so long ago, talking about the death of proper investigative journalism in this country. You know, and I think this is our downfall with the media now. The media seems to be reading off a script from somewhere, and we can all guess where that is. But if you
that's right. I mean, we were talking about this just on Friday, and by the way, there is actually, we're doing a debate in a few weeks' time. Which is, maybe it's 2 weeks' time, I'm not even sure, but without looking it up, but we've got the head of journalism at the University of the West of England, plus Tim Tate, who's used to work for Yorkshire Television, and made a really controversial documentary, what's it called? Conspiracy of Silence, about the Franklin scandal in the United States and child sexual abuse going on in the Republican Party, which was cost $500,000. From Discovery Channel, but although they paid him the money, they never showed it. Anyway, so we've got this. That will be quite a good, I think, sort of 45-minute discussion. Is investigative journalism dead?
Sorry, where's that taking place?
So that will be happening in the next few weeks. But yeah, I mean, that whole subject of is all around about. It's not just about money, because these big media corporations do have a lot of money. It's about that having the political will to do it. You know, it just isn't there anymore. We get a very shoddy version. I mean,
do you think it is there, but people are actually too scared now to come
forward?
No, it's
not about that. It's just about control of the networks. I mean, look, the people that own, as I said at the start, you know, the networks, there's only a handful of them. Let's go back to Roger Cook, the Cook Report, which, by the way, was the most popular current affairs program ever in Britain.
Is it true that David Cameron binned that?
Sorry?
Is it true that David Cameron actually binned that when he was...
I don't know about that. No, I don't think David Cameron did it himself, but it was certainly around the time that he was at Carlton Television. But look, the Cook Report, yes, you're right. I mean, the archives of it apparently were burnt, according to Roger. And so Roger put out an appeal for people to dig through their lofts to find old VHSs of the Cook Report to put on YouTube, because that would be the only way to look at some of them. I mean, that program looked at things like child sexual abuse, satanic abuse ring in Leeds, for example. It looked at the trading of nuclear weapons on the black market.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which was one of the most shocking of all of them, where an SS-20 hydrogen bomb like launcher, you know, with a ballistic missile launcher, mobile one, a bit like the old cruise missiles we had over here from the Yanks, was offered for sale to Roger, which he rather opened his eyes. You know, this kind of stuff was top end investigative journalism and stings, this kind of thing. So he did one also on the National Front, which was brilliant. Looking into the, you know, sort of their attempt to hide the deep-rooted fascism and racism going on in there, and poor old Roger was, although he was pulling in, it was 10 million viewers a week to that show, which is obviously what the advertisers want. They want the 10 million people watching their adverts.
Yeah.
What happened was the News of the World ran a over 3 or 4 weeks, ran a whole load of lies about Roger's program, and it got pulled, but it never got put back again. Now, you have to ask yourself questions. Now, we do know that that format of show will pull in a massive audience,
yeah.
And if a network has got the guts to do it, they should be doing it. They don't have the guts. The networks don't have the political will to challenge the rich and powerful. That is largely, I think, because they are involved far too much with the same bankers, the same oil companies, and the same financiers of all sorts, and royalty as well, that we see at these Bilderberg conferences. I actually bring it back to that again, because they're all in the same friendly little club with each other, and of course everybody is beholden to the bankers. The bankers are really ruling the roost in this kind of weird feudal system, which is part of, I suppose, in the old days it was land. Nowadays it's vast amounts of money and banking systems. So what I'd like to see done is to take away the licenses from some of these banks.
Yeah, no, that sounds like, you know, they are.
Well, it's simple to do, actually.
Yeah.
A drop of a hat, the government could do this. But
it's someone having the galls and the guts to, one, suggest it, and two, enforce it. But I think, you know, our financial, how can I put, the the guys, the FS, the FCA, they're weak, they're toothless, like most of our quangos, like Ofcom, Ofgem.
Well, they're paid for by the banks, you know. The other thing, of course, is the bailout in 2008 was about 700 billion or so altogether. I don't know how much of that actually got paid back to the government so far, but I mean, that was what it was costing. Imagine how much that would do in our schools, hospitals, social services, etc. You know, but that money has been used by the banks to lobby for more change, more power, successfully, and they've been simply riding roughshod over politics slowly. But I mean, I don't know if you know, I was watching it this morning actually, but back in 1999, Adam Curtis, the BBC documentary maker, made a terrific series of four. Hour-long, I think it was 50-minute documentaries called The Mayfair Set, where what he looked at was the whole sort of Thatcher era, and before it actually, where the business community and the banks got together to just basically sideline democracy. Yeah, so what we're talking about is first of all lobbying and controlling the top ends of the political parties, but more importantly acquiring massive amounts of wealth through asset stripping. And that was what was going on in the 70s and in the 80s, which has led, I think, to the situation where we are today, where you've got a kind of fake economy churning around with people doing financial services which nobody really wants, no manufacturing happening, and all of the quantitative easing money going into pumping up a massive bubble in the stock exchange, which could go bang at any minute. I mean, quite literally bang, which would mean all of a sudden the entire confected system of economics, people would lose their jobs overnight, what jobs they have, and we'd be in a situation where we simply couldn't feed our kids, and what would happen then? I mean, the great thing, one thing I would say about the Russians is half their food in Russia is grown on small holdings and by families. So when they had a massive financial disaster in 1990, they hardly noticed it. I mean, of course they did, but, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs. But a lot of them just went to their little country retreats, they called dachas, and started eating their own food. We're in a situation in Britain where we just simply couldn't do that. Our cities would become no-go zones. I mean, you know, we're in a quite a dangerous spot.
Very dangerous spot.
When it comes to the actual fragility that we've got ourselves into. Lack of food security, a lot of our land, we're not even growing food anymore, we're importing it, we're putting solar farms up in the countryside, and there's a total air of unreality to it, which to me smacks of a deliberate attempt to get the population into the state where they have to kind of go to the government cap in hand and do what they're told. You know, this is dangerous territory. There's no freedom when you've got to beg the government for your next meal.
That seems like where they want to take us, isn't it? You're quite right. And it seems the only way they've got to go now, and the only thing left to pick, is unfortunately people's pension pots now. And
that was great in the budget last week. Yeah. Even more releasing of the pension pot. Well, what's this doing? it's just allowing much more money to be available for the buy-to-let market, because we're getting to the stage where all of the special incentives that have been given by the Help to Buy scheme from the last few years from the Treasury to help people buy homes, that is to allow them to borrow more money. By the way, that was what caused the financial crisis in the first place. That is starting to peter out, and people have borrowed as much as they can, and they've conned as many people to borrow that money, and now what they want to do is release more money to keep that housing market buoyant.
Okay.
That seems to be the only, and of course the other part of that is that they're actually encouraging foreign people to buy British property. You know, so we're in a situation in Bristol here with quite a lot of, you know, luxury flats have just simply been bought by foreigners as an investment. They're empty,
and they're staying
not
empty,
being used, and yet we've got 15,000 people in the city of Bristol, which is about 450,000 altogether if you include some of the outlying areas. We've got 15,000 of those people officially homeless,
and it's the same if you look around the Docklands area as well, and in parts of South London just outside Deptford. There's developments going on there, and they're just being whisked up like by foreigners and being left empty. Meanwhile, I thought there was meant to be some sort of social housing deal now that's done with these developers, that they have to build a certain percentage of social housing if they're building new developments. But
they have done for a very long time now. I think they're called Section 106 agreements. But look, you know, that what's happening in Bristol is for example, our general hospital, which was owned by the NHS, got sold off by a merchant venturer boss of the NHS. In the United Hospital of Bristol NHS Trust, John Savage, you know, oversaw that. And that was going to be turned into housing and a good proportion of affordable housing that is built by housing associations and possibly even the council. But what happened was the developers said they just refused. They said, well, it's not viable if we do the social housing. So they then got applied again for planning permission, got planning permission to turn the whole lot into luxury flats. So that's relatively new. In the past,
right,
local authorities and the planners usually, you know, had the clout to force developers to allow social housing. That's going out the window, I'm afraid, bit by bit. But look, I would say one positive thing, and amazingly relating to the child sexual abuse scandal, which we mentioned earlier on, you know, with this total impunity, Pinochet fascist style, that's been going on in Britain here, to these horrendous, horrific crimes. Largely, I think Martin really, you know, Martin Summers on our show talks about this. It was there for the idea of blackmailing politicians.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be the prime motive, as well as certain people, you know, with hideous tendencies. But that whole business has actually opened up the possibility for this now to be taken seriously, not just by the police, but also, of course, by MPs, journalists. I mean, there are some really good MPs who've been real stalwart campaigners on this in the last parliament, not least of which, of course, is Tom Watson.
Yeah.
And this is now starting to really get some traction. I think in the past, there was a possibility, I mean, I'm talking about in the sort of 60s, 70s and 80s and 90s, there was the possibility that, you know, this could be just dismissed as some kind of silly conspiracy theory.
Well, we had two,
you know, people
we?
Wouldn't yeah. be believed. They yeah. were kind of driven into their own hell by being told, look, nobody cares about this, you know, you're not taken seriously. I even have a friend who's he was editor of a newspaper up north, and he was sexually abused himself as a young boy by a district commissioner in the Scouts. And years later, he went to the police. I think this is in the 1990s to report it to the police. And the police came back to see him. CID came around to see him a few weeks afterwards to say, "Well, this guy's dead now." Well, he found out in about 2010-ish, the guy hadn't been dead at all. So the police had been lying to him about that, even back in the 1990s. And you know that has a horrific effect on you as an individual, where the police just lie to you flat to your face,
yeah,
to say, oh, the guy's dead, and then you find out a few years later, oh, he was still alive, they could have arrested him. You know, this is a hideous system we're living under, and that's now being blown wide open.
Well,
by
it's
the
coming
Jimmy,
right
Jimmy
from, Savile. From the top, isn't it? I mean, we only have to harp back to the end of last year. I think it was the 14th of November 2014 when David Cameron said these are nothing more than conspiracy theories. Prior to that, we had Kenneth Clark saying that these are just silly stories and a load of nonsense from the 80s and early 90s.
Well, why would we believe Kenneth Clark? I mean, you know, anything he said, I would almost automatically think the opposite is probably true.
What do you make?
But it really has, and I think it's given confidence and some solace to people who've been abused in the past.
Yeah, but then you look at cases like the Ben Fellows case. Now, that again, that draws some parallels with the Roger Cook program. He was a young guy working on that program at the time. He made allegations against Kenneth Clark of inappropriate touching. And now we've got this coming, you know, Kenneth Clark being the Justice Minister. It seemed to me that there were some dodgy dealings going on there when Ben finally, you know, was brave enough to come out and say something against Kenneth Clark. But look how he's been treated. We see this with whistleblowers more and more. The more the people that are standing up and speaking out, we've got the Melanie Shaw case. She broke the Nottingham care home scandal. She's now in prison. She's been treated absolutely appallingly.
Yeah, I think what you're doing, hang on, if I can just stop you a second, is you're focusing on a couple of really awful examples. Now, thankfully, there are nowadays only a few bad examples. Most people have got a reasonable confidence, not only to communicate with some police, I'm not saying all police forces, I personally wouldn't touch the Met with a barge pole.
No.
But some of the you know, the regional police forces, the county police forces, are actually really are starting to take this seriously. We've had a case, for example, here with Avon and Somerset Police, where the mayor of Weston-super-Mare has been arrested and jailed for child pornography, and you know, he's a Conservative and also a Freemason, by the way.
Yeah.
So there are some forces around the country that have taken, you know, are starting really starting to get in. So I think it's really important not to talk this down. I think there's been a big sea change across the country.
Well, I think there has to be,
particularly because of his contacts with the Royals, his contacts with the NSPCC, his contacts with the BBC. I mean, all the centres of power, Jimmy Savile had his arm around these people, and people are now realising, actually, there is this utter crookedness at the top. The police are slowly starting to act. So, yes, you're right. There are one or two examples where they haven't. And that is important. But it's, I think, also important to encourage people to actually start talking about this. Because once they start talking about it, people will start going to, they are starting to go to jail. I must admit, you know, with the MPs, you know, that hasn't happened. But, yeah, you know, we need to just encourage people to be honest and not to, you know, be really careful not to be fear-mongering about that.
Well, I'm really not
things
trying...
Things are changing, they really are. I mean, Liz McKean broke that story originally on Newsnight. Well, she wasn't allowed to break it on Newsnight, was she? I'm pleased to say, I used to work with her years ago in BBC in Marylebone High Street, and, you know, she was a pretty feisty young reporter in her late 20s when I was working with her. Fantastic woman. And it was just brilliant to see the way that she just was not going to take no for an answer. From, I think it was Peter Rippon, who was Newsnight's editor at the time, and made sure that, because you imagine, as a reporter, you take months to convince somebody to go on camera and talk about that sort of thing, to relive that experience. It's a difficult thing to do in the first place. But then to be told that footage is not going to be used because we've got a Jimmy Savile special coming up at Christmas.
Just terrible.
It's just about the most appalling decision. And the thing is, this is now, a lot of people have got their heads around the way the BBC really works, and also even people at the BBC, I can tell you, some of them are really angry about this and really annoyed, particularly people who are part of the National Union of Journalists, you know, the trade union, which, you know, is actually pretty strong in the BBC still. It's nice to see a bit of trade union activity still going on, and, for example, has managed to force all sorts of concessions with attempts to get rid of pensions and things like that. So there is a bit of political muscle, and you don't necessarily know what the union and what reporters and journalists are still managing to get out through the BBC, because you know, you don't know what's going on behind the scenes.
Well,
neither do I, a lot
it
of the
just
time.
Worries me, Tony, when you hear of three people in sort of alternative media, as it were, being contacted by the BBC by their Panorama programme. Two of them marking name, which was Bill Maloney and Andrea Davidson, have been contacted by the Panorama programme, and it's looking like they were targeting people that had broke CSA stories, and there was obviously an agenda behind that, because it's been dropped now. It's there's news that the BBC have dropped doing
well,
that.
Well, this is the bad eggs, isn't it, in the BBC? This is the con men, the liars, the crooks, the criminals, actually, because what they're doing is covering up for crime. I mean, we've got this case tomorrow, haven't we, in court with Matt Campbell.
Yeah, I wanted to come on to that.
Take to court over exactly this. You know, I'm not paying my licence fee because I'm not paying for people to aid and abet terrorism. And that's what the BBC quite clearly have been doing with their 9/11 coverage, for example, which is, in Matt's case, I would argue they did the same with the 7/7 coverage, which I was involved in that conspiracy files or programme on the 7/7 London bombings. And the reason I got involved in all that was because I was working on the IRA terrorism when I was working in London back in the early 1990s, you know, IRA bombs going off, and I was covering them. And then when I saw the 7/7 thing happen, I took a close look at it, and I thought, this is just not right. There's no questions being asked by the journalists here.
Just to give people a brief background on Matt Campbell and what's happening tomorrow, he's is it Reinvestigate 9/11.org today announced that the letter was sent to Ambassador Matthew W. Barzan by the 9/11 UK victim family member Matt Campbell, challenging the official US narrative of 9/11. The letter sent out serious omissions and distortions of the 9/11 Commission reports, which cast massive doubt over the veracity of the official narrative. Copy of the letter was also sent to President Obama. Now, Matt Campbell lost his brother, Jeff Campbell, who was 31 at the time on the September 11th, 2001 atrocities. He's spoken with senior police, counter-terrorism officers and Foreign and Commonwealth Office over his concerns surrounding the official narrative of the events, especially the 9/11 Commission reports, which, in the words of the 9/11 Commission Chairman Keane and Vice Chairman Hamilton, was delayed, underfunded and set up to fail. Now, what is it specifically Matt's going to court with tomorrow? Is it to do with the BBC report on the...
Well, this is the TV licence thing. I mean, this is the great thing. I would encourage anybody, if they don't think that the BBC have been telling the truth about the September the 11th attacks, if they think they're covering up the real crime and the real criminals, then there is quite clearly a case for people paying the BBC to be party to that terrorist attack. And that's what Matt's doing tomorrow in court. I think it's in Hastings, isn't it?
It is in Hastings. I think Kai, who's normally on with us, he's down that way anyway at the moment, and I think he's turning up there tomorrow as well to give some support.
Lovely. Well, I mean, this is important stuff because, you know, what you'll see is the handful of crooks and criminals in the BBC will be actually tearing their hair out, and this will be a problem for them, whereas the vast majority of, you know, honest people who sort of look across the desk at the crooks and say, good God, what the hell are they doing in this office?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been in some of these production offices, and I mean, the atmosphere sometimes is just horrific. It is like a war zone, a mini war zone, you know. and it's a bit like you know, say the Middle East or somewhere like that, but just writ large in a newsroom. No one's shooting each other, but God, if looks could kill, you know. And that's, I'm afraid, not a healthy atmosphere to be telling the truth and, you know, and creating good news stories and, you know, getting good stuff out to the public. At least that's, you know, that's my experience of a good busy newsroom is where everyone's pulling together.
Yeah.
Not where you've got, you know, spooks in your newsroom who are just using the news media as an outlet to lie to millions of people, which is what's been going on with it.
How big do you think that problem is with the BBC, Tony?
Look, let's be careful though not to focus too much on the B, because the person that wants all this attack on the BBC, of course, is Rupert Murdoch. He wants to have the field clear for his Sky Television and his various other networks, like he took over IRN, didn't he? Almost all the independent radio news services you hear around the country on the hour on the radio are also controlled by Murdoch. You know, this is you've got to be really careful. I mean, the BBC should be accountable because we have to pay for it. We're forced to pay for it. And it is supposed to be a public service, and, you know, to quite a great degree, particularly with regional news, etc., it is a public service. It's just that, you know, by having a go at the BBC, Rupert Murdoch, you can see him sitting in the background rubbing
having
his
a giggle.
Hands,
yeah.
Salivating, you know, God, look at that market. And he complains, of course, to the Conservative government. Jeremy Hunt was Culture Secretary. He's saying, well, the BBC is unfair competition. I think they should just be closed down. You know, and if we're not careful, they will be. I think what really needs to happen is you know, better governance at the BBC. And I can nail the exact time where the BBC started going over to the dark side, and that was beginning of 1987. Seamus Milne, who has a Guardian columnist, wrote a piece about it a few weeks ago in the Guardian. And Seamus Milne's dad was Alistair, well, you know, he's dead now, but was Alistair Milne, who was the Director General of the BBC in the 1960s, 70s, all the really good stuff that we can remember. He was the end of that era, and what happened was that it was during the Thatcher era, obviously the 80s, and there was a lot of really good programmes being put out which were anti-Thatcher. I mean, there was both sides, obviously, but, I mean, for example, Panorama did a programme called Maggie's Militant Tendency,
right,
which was looking at the far right in the Tory party at the time. Everyone was moaning about Labour militants, saying that aren't they far too left-wing. Well, anyway, what Panorama did was to show actually Margaret Thatcher was guilty of exactly the same thing with the far right in the Tory party, Jonathan Aitken and various other people who were going to these fascist rallies. So that was really interesting to see. There was another programme called My Country Right or Wrong, which was looking at the whole Northern Ireland conflict in the middle of the Troubles, and actually giving a voice to people from the Republican movement, which was thought to be dreadful. Anyway, what happened was Thatcher didn't like this, and she saw the BBC as her own private property, and the chairman of the BBC at the time was a guy called Marmaduke Hussey. When his autobiography came out, I bought it straight away and had a look through what happened at the, when Milne was sacked. And Marmaduke Hussey says something very interesting in his autobiography. He says, "Victor Rothschild approached me and asked me, can you sack the Director General of the BBC?" This is in 1986. Right. So Hussey then says, "Oh well, I suppose I probably can, you know." And then Victor Rothschild then helped him, who was a Labour peer, by the way, then helped him to look at the various methods they could use to kick out Alistair Milne as Director General, and they basically got rid of him in the winter of 1986, beginning of 1987, because of all these programmes he'd been doing, which were embarrassing for the government, which is actually his job, by the way. And as a result, the new guy, they hadn't actually organised it very well, this coup at the BBC. And by the way, of course, there was a very British coup, which is kind of similar in a way. You know, it's a similar kind of thing about the power of the mainstream press, the BBC particularly. But Michael Checkland was brought in as Director General, and he was just the BBC accountant. This is the first time ever the creative director of the corporation had been an accountant. Can you believe that? And you know what they've done over the years? I did some video training stuff, video editing training, and this is the BBC have been obsessed with this attitude ever since. What they do is they find accountants within the BBC and then they train them up to be video editors.
Yeah.
You know, so they've got this, they love this mentality. I mean, some of them are probably Freemasons too, but they've got this mentality that they're easier to control, that creative people are dangerous. Anyway, so Michael Checkland was Director General for a while.
They cost money as
And then they brought in John Burt. That's when I was working there. And John Burt just completely destroyed the corporation by doing this thing like of cost centres. I think they called it producer choice, if I remember rightly. And the idea was it had been one big happy family, like literally thousands of people just cooperating to tell the public what they needed to know. And I used to phone up the sports department, you know, you'd phone up a local regional office to find out some local colour on a story. You know, you might talk to an expert anywhere in the corporation to get a little bit of help with the story, or even to get a quote, or to, you know, for them to get a bit of a soundbite and some footage. What happened with when John Burt came in after the Thatcher coup was simply all of the communications around the corporation then had to be applied for and by paperwork on through the producer, through the editor, and it became a massive bureaucracy. It was like almost like we were compartmentalized, a classic pyramid structure. And from there on, it was sort of, you know, struggling to get
anything
done.
A business unit,
and that was
it?
The effect of this getting rid of Alistair Milne and bringing in John Burt. I mean, by the way, John Burt's still around. He now is part one of the companies that controls the, I think it's called Eurotel. Gosh, I'm not sure. One of the big satellite owning companies. One of the satellites, for example, which switched off Press TV a couple of years ago, the Iranian channel. So they control a lot of what we see and hear still. John Burt is actually a major player in what we see and hear and knowing what's going on around the
so
world.
So do you think he had his hand in with the Ofcom decision there at some stage with regards to Press TV?
Well, you know, he seems to be very much in with this sort of Masonic Zionist elite, you know, this kind of elitist.
Well, talking of which, I know this is one of your favourite subjects. I just checked out the InfoWars website with regards to, I'd done a Bilderberg search on the net, and it was the first site that come up announcing that the location and dates for the forthcoming 2015 gathering of the secretive elites under the Bilderberg Group banner has been confirmed. Local police have verified that the conference will take place at the opulent boats into Alpena Hotel in the Austrian mountains of near Telfs. In a press release, the Australian police revealed that the security for the confab will be in operation from the 9th to the 14th of June. Tony, for those that, you know, may have not heard about the Bilderberg Group, this is a very secretive society, isn't it? And was it last year that you went to
the year before last, 2013, it was brilliant, actually. It was, you know what, made me proud to be British. That sounds a strange thing to say, but it really did, because
everyone was there.
There had been such an enormous protest and such a well-organised protest, which was effectively a kind of teaching symposium over 3 or 4 days. I mean, it was a brilliant event, and it was beautiful weather. You know, the Bilderbergs did their dastardly work, you know, as they normally do. Like, for example, they'd made an agreement with the Fringe Festival organisers to supply water. On the Thursday, they reneged on their decision, and so everyone was sort of, oh, right, so this is the sort of mentality of these people. They say they're going to supply you with some bottled water, and at the last minute they say no. So, you know, this is just, you know, perfect Bilderberg territory in a way, because you just know they're evil when they do that sort of thing.
So
and the other thing was the BBC Three turned up kind of spoof thing. So it was an amazing few days, but it was, you know, it was unlike anything I've ever seen at a Bilderberg conference before, and I think that's wonderful in a way to see that the Brits will react to it in that way. I don't think they were at all comfortable with the way that there was such a lot of press coverage as well. I mean, it was pretty much every major press outlet in Britain.
There was lots of them did
cover it, you know, in some way.
Yeah.
And they certainly weren't, you know, weren't positive about it. And this is the thing the Bilderberg hates more than anything else, because they're just under a rock, under a stone. They like hiding away. To have the national press coverage, they really hate that more than anything else, because the idea is they're not supposed to exist. I mean, they are actually the secret government. There's the secret power lobby behind the scenes, set up in 1954. By the way, in the same exact spot, their first Bilderberg meeting, the Bilderberg Hotel, is in the same spot as a massacre in 1944.
Right. Was it a Nazi that started it up, wasn't it? A former Nazi?
Well, it was started really by two people. Joseph Rettinger, who was a Freemason, a Polish Mason who was working for MI6, and he was the aide to Polish General Sikorsky during World War II, but miraculously wasn't on the plane which crashed with Sikorsky on it, because, of course, you know, Churchill basically was selling the Poles out. He couldn't have General Sikorsky banging his fist on the table. So Rettinger was one of the people that started it. The other one was Prince Bernhard, this former SS officer.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing to understanding Bilderberg, I think, is their little in-joke about where the Bilderberg name comes from and the hotel. And that hotel is in Oosterbeek in Holland, which was the venue for a particularly horrific battle in September 1944, which was portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far, Cornelius Ryan's book, and Joseph E. Levine film, I think, with some real big names in there, Robert Redford, etc. And that film is really well worth watching with the Bilderberg in the back of your mind, because at one point, as the British troops were advancing, because the whole film really is about the attempted liberation of Holland, and Bernhard was a former SS officer, former German, but he married before the war into the Dutch royal family, and so he was kind of out of Germany. And he was in Britain, amazingly enough. King George VI, Freemason, and obviously part of a German family, and his brother was an enthusiastic Nazi, Edward VIII, who'd married Mrs. Simpson, and then tried to get into Nazi Germany. The king, the former king of England, actually made an attempt to get into Nazi Germany so he could then broadcast propaganda, you know, from Germany. So, you know, King George VI was no squeaky clean chap by any means. Anyway, he allowed Bernhard to have the top level of security clearance so he could be in on all of the war plans. So, I mean, the Nazis really didn't necessarily need to have any spies if they've got Bernhard right in there at the top as an ex-Nazi himself. And the proof I would proffer for that is because he sent this spy in at the beginning of Operation Market Garden, the Bridge Too Far film, just before the paratroopers all dropped into Holland, a guy called Christian Lindemans, he was the spy, and he had the code name King Kong. And he sent this guy in to do all the liaison on the ground with the Dutch resistance so that they could be prepared for this massive liberation and the paratroopers to come in, etc., to liberate Holland. Anyway, I mean, this isn't portrayed in the film at all, but it's all absolutely cast iron fact. I interviewed a guy who's a top journalist in Holland. This is now quite an interesting story. A lot of Dutch people reading about this over the last few years. But Lindemans, it turned out, was actually working for the Abwehr. That is the Nazi army intelligence. And when they dropped him in from Britain, he went straight to Nazi intelligence and told them everything he knew about the plans to invade, rather than going to the Dutch resistance. So this is Bernhard's little protege.
Right.
It does indicate that Bernhard wasn't actually, you know, in any way sympathetic to the Allied cause in the war. And then he was the chairman of the Bilderberg for the first 20 years or so, until he was embarrassed in the Lockheed scandal in 1975. So this is, to me, a Nazi organisation born in Oosterbeek in the Bilderberg Hotel, which was called the Witch's Cauldron in 1944, in this Arnhem battle, where British troops, the 1st Airborne Division, the bulk of it anyway, was totally surrounded by the most hideous kind of SS rocket, Nebelwerfer attack, machine guns, tanks, flamethrowers, God knows what else, an absolute massacre. And they chose that exact same spot to start this whole Bilderberg conference off. The other person who was involved as a chairman of Bilderberg in that battle was Lord Carrington, who was part of the Guards Armoured Division advancing along the road. And you can see him in the film too, you know, The Bridge Too Far. What they do is they get to Nijmegen, which is the penultimate bridge, and Bernhard isn't around at the time, but Carrington is. He's sitting there in his tank with all these tanks behind him, and he says, "Oh well, we're just going to stay here. My orders are to stay here." Now, he had a clear road. We now know there was nothing stopping him and his fellow friend tankers just getting it, sitting in their tanks and zooming up the road. I think it's about something like 8-10 miles in the night, so they wouldn't be able to be picked off by anti-tank guns, who wouldn't be able to see them. They could have got to Arnhem and reinforced the bridge quite without any problem. We now know there were only a few security pickets, that is, a few guys with a few rifles, a handful of people halfway along that road. So if they'd gone then that could have ended the war by Christmas. No. But Carrington didn't go. He stayed there. He drank his tea. The American guy I interviewed, Moffat Burris, who was one of the American paratroopers that took the bridge, said he went up to Carrington. He pointed his Tommy gun at Carrington's head and he said, "Get down that blankety blank road before I blow your blankety blank head off." And Carrington then got into his Sherman tank, locked the hatch, and Moffat Burris said, "I couldn't get at him." You know, so they'd taken the Nijmegen Bridge so that these tanks could charge down the road to Arnhem to end the war by Christmas. And Carrington instead decides he's going to make a cup of tea. Then when the Americans ask him what he's doing, he disappears into his tank, you know, and stays the night in there. He doesn't want to win the battle.
Right.
Anyway, so, you know, brilliant, it's story. Always easy with hindsight to look into these things. But there is a lot of stuff to do with that which convinces me that the Bilderberg conferences, right from the start, were a sort of in-joke, well, look what we did towards the end of World War II to allow the Nazis that extra 6 months to squirrel away their gold, their securities all around the world, to start a Fourth Reich, a kind of financial empire, to replace the tanks with finance. You know, you take over, but you just do it with money. You don't use tanks.
Yeah. Well, it seems they lost the war, but they're winning the battle, as it were.
Well, yeah, I mean, officially they did, but then, of course, you know, there was a lot of... I mean, the Nazis, as Jonathan Meade says in his brilliant... you know, the TV guy did a brilliant thing called Jerry Building, which was looking at Nazi architecture, and he opens the show saying the Nazism did not die in 1945. It just took off its swastikas, it took off its uniform, put on a nice suit and sauntered into the post-war world. And he's absolutely right about that. There's a you know, quite a lot of evidence, particularly by a US CBS news correspondent in the Second World War. One of the best books I would imagine, you know, your listeners have never read, and I don't know if you have ever read, but it's by Paul Manning, who was working for CBS in World War II, covering the European war for the American public. And in the early 1980s, he published a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which really looked at this kind of post-war Fourth Reich network of companies and finance and laundered gold and money from World War II. I mean, this is the question no one ever seems to ask, is what happened to all the Nazi loot at the end of the war? Well, I can tell you, Paul Manning traced it, and it basically, Bormann survived the war in South America, set up 750 corporations.
Wow.
And on the boards of those corporations, he appointed ex-SS people, some with new identities, some just people who were sympathetic to the Nazi cause, and then injected all this laundered cash into those companies. Goodness knows where they are now, but you know, certainly it was a beginning of an enormous financial army, basically an incredible
story. Tony, before we move on, we've got Sabine McNeil coming in about 5 minutes time, and I corresponded with her earlier today. She's very interested in your take on the revelations from the Hampstead whistleblower kids case that I think it was on Thursday that there was a judgment made by Judge Pawfley. She summed up by saying an evil internet campaign about satanic cult operating at a Hampstead school was a fantasy and nothing other than utter nonsense.
Well, that's what we all very often hear, isn't it, until the truth comes out. But I'm going to have to disappoint her, I'm afraid, because I've not really followed that. I mean, I certainly interviewed her about it, but she's the expert, not me. The other thing I'd say in the meantime is I think it's also good to, you know, to talk positive, because a lot of this stuff's pretty dark, but there are some really superb figures out there, I think, and I'm thinking particularly about from the United States. I mean, I do some, I think some, you know, talk some fantastic US people, and in a way, we've got this kind of special relationship with the Americans officially, you know, haven't we? Which is actually a bit of a disaster. It's basically doing whatever these US fascists seem to want us to do.
Yeah.
But there is this chap called William Cooper. I don't know if you've come across him.
No.
He was a naval intelligence officer in the Vietnam War, etc. And he then set up his own radio program in the States. He got very disillusioned with the direction of US military policy. But, you know, being an intelligence officer, he was privy to a lot of stuff, and he realized that there was all sorts of stuff going on over there. The American military fed him a whole load of rubbish about aliens, and he went along with that for a while. But he was a radio presenter, I think it was in Arizona or somewhere like that, where he used to run an FM radio station in his local town, but it was also out on shortwave, so people from all over the US used to tune into William Cooper. He then realized that the alien stuff was all a hoax, and he said it on his show. He said, look, I've been talking about this for 10 years about the aliens, but I've slowly come to realize I've been conned, and it's all a load of rubbish. This is all the idea is a cover for high-tech military experimentation,
right.
And I've just been conned, you know. So I like William Cooper. I love William Cooper, actually, because he's one of those people who's prepared to admit that he didn't know and he got it wrong. It's very, very few people that have the humility to do that these days. You know, I'd like to think that that's the sort of thing I would say. Well, I'll roll back on something if I think I've got it wrong. Most definitely, I'm not proud. So Bill Cooper, check his stuff out. The Hour of the Time is his, and he's very much, I think, correct in tracing back a lot of the wickedness we see today back literally thousands of years through the mystery religions. Freemasonry quite clearly didn't just start in the 1700s out of nowhere. You know, it's been going on for centuries. It's a cult, you know.
Yeah.
It's part of a religious cult where we had the Templars all those years ago back in the 1300s. They were suppressed. And there's a lot of history, I think, which we don't get. You know, when by understanding that history, I think it helps us a lot to understand today. Also, Dennis Wheatley, a great writer, and he was one of the most popular authors in the world in the 1960s and 1970s, British writer. He was involved in the war effort, one of the world's first ever psychological warfare officers working in Whitehall in World War II, doing things like predicting what the Nazis were going to do if they were going to invade Britain, and he was proved after the war to be pretty much right, but also involved in doing things like wining and dining people like Aleister Crowley,
right.
And some of the people from the, you know, sort of black magic side, and getting to know them and writing, of course, the Devil Rides Out, and which was made into a film, which is one of the great occult novels of the 20th century. Also, I would also point to Rachel Carson. I don't know if you've come across her, the American woman.
No, not Rachel.
Rachel Carson is an amazing character. She wrote a book, I think it was in the early 60s, called Silent Spring, which is about the overuse of technology in farming and pesticides.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, she was almost like a prophetess of our modern world. You know, she's talking about, look, you know, if we start using these pesticides, it's going to get into the food chain, blah, 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 blah. But she was one of the first people to recognize that there's this pernicious, not only is it killing people, all these poisons, but it's also making a handful of people absolutely super wealthy and super rich.
Monsanto, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. Rachel did an amazing job. I think there's been some really brilliant people in the last, you know, sort of really, I suppose, in the last 80, since the end of World War II, who've just got virtually no recognition in the mainstream media. And what I'd say is that mainstream media has got sarin gas being injected into it. It's almost like they're the nerve system of humanity is being hit by nerve gas. You know, that's the way I see Murdoch. He's a nerve gas, injecting nerve gas into the whole body politic.
Totally agree. Well, Tony, you're quite welcome to stay on if you want the other side of just going to take a quick break in a minute, but you're quite welcome to stay on with come on with Sabine if you'd like.
Yeah, what I'd like to do, if it's all right with you, is go and make a cuppa, come back, have a listen, and then interject as
Yeah, sure. You're quite welcome to. Thanks, Tony. Okay. Excellent. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break now. Whilst we're doing that, we're going to get our next guest on the line, which is Sabine McNeil. We're going to be looking at the Hampstead case, the whistleblower kids, and the recent judgment in that case. So don't go away. Tweet us at Bastion Radio, or Skype in bastion.radio, or get in touch via the email studio@bastionradio.com. And of course, the telephone number 0117 230 0558. Well, joining me on the line now, hopefully, is Sabine McNeil. Hello, Sabine.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
Well, trying to recover.
Yes, I can imagine with the news that we've seen in our mainstream media over the last couple of days. But the summing up, the Paul Flea summing up, has come quite of a shock. I've downloaded the report. It's quite big. It's 157 points. Can you hear me, Sabine?
I'm trying to recover, quite frankly.
Yeah, well, I was quite shocked at the statement at the end where she said that an evil internet campaign about satanic cult operating at Hampstead School was fantasy and nothing other than nonsense. That's what she summed it up with. You know, I'm looking at this, pages and pages of...
Well, there is some other sound going on, isn't there? It's not just our conversation.
I think, I've got Tony on the line. He may have left his mic open. So that's maybe what you're hearing. He's gone off to make a cup of tea or something, so he's going to interject in a minute. Is that what you can hear?
I listen to Tony. I listen to your conversation, but
Looks like you've got some feedback on in the background. Have you got the program on as well? Yeah, Sabine, I think you may have a browser open with the live stream going out on still.
Oh, that's what it is.
Ah, yeah, it sounds like, because I can hear it coming back now, so it sounds like you've got your stream open in the background somewhere.
Yes, now it's clearer.
Ah, that's better. That's it, I'm not hearing myself twice. I say, I've got this report here. As you can see, it's pages and pages and pages. It seems to be riddled with contradictions, and when you get to the bit about medical evidence and things like that, and the doctor involved, it seems to me there was no regard to that medical report. This is my personal view. I just think it's another clear, utter cover-up from Paul Flea, who seems to be involved in these cases.
I'm delighted that that's your first impression.
Oh, it is my first impression,
I actually expected a judgment about the fate of the children. Where would they go? The worst would be to the father, and of course the best to the grandparents.
But wasn't this was like a summing up, not a summing up, it was like an investigation. investigation into the investigation, as it were. It was a special, was it 12-day case or something? But this wasn't necessarily to judge on what's going to happen with the kid yet. Isn't that going to be a further case?
Well, no, but of course that has to be the outcome. I mean, it was the so-called fact-finding hearing, but, I mean, the judgment is obviously supposed to decide about the fate of the children. But, of course, that has been the whole problem, that at the hearing of January 26, the judge ignored the mother's position statement, and that's when she and Belinda McKenzie came out of the hearing saying she has no intention of returning the children. And that's why we started the petition on February 2nd to return the children. And that eventually led to the internet explosion. And our impression is now that this judgment was really made mainly to counter the internet explosion, to tell us off, yeah, to tell us who's the boss, and that their machinery with the mainstream media is a hell of a lot more effective than we little people on the internet.
Yeah.
After all, they've managed to delete lots and lots of videos on YouTube. They've managed to close my 3 accounts on Facebook, plus banned other people.
Well, it's all been one-sided, isn't it?
Behind them as well.
One witness.
So this is quite serious, in my view, what's happened. But the really positive side of this judgment is, in my view, that after Seville made the term paedophilia topical, now Ms. Powfley has made the term Satanism topical.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it seems to me a very one-sided case because, I mean, she made light of the fact that the mother wasn't there to represent herself, and neither was her partner. But the fact is that she was intimidated out of the country. You know, so she was on a bad footing from the start, which seems to be a particular pattern in some cases that we've looked into to people whistleblowing, especially involving schools. We had Brian Gerrish on last week who told us about the case of a mother down in Cornwall that had done the same and had come across the inappropriate pictures of children were being passed around the school between teachers. And she was evidently arrested, and they tried to section her, and they were forcing drugs on her. So we have seen cases where individuals have stood up against this. If you're part of a group, it seems that you seem to be in a safer position to do this whistleblowing. But Judge Powfley, one of her statements in the opening parts was, "I'm able to state with complete conviction that none of the allegations are true. I am entirely certain that everything Mrs. Draper, her partner Abraham Christie, and the children said about those matters were fabricated. These claims are baseless. Those who have sought to perpetrate them are evil and or foolish." Now, this to me seems like a typical pattern on labelling people that, you know, are going against the grain, as it were, because in that court there was a witness there that said they had up to 16 different people working for the local authority and the court to try and slam this case down, but there was no representation at all of the parents on that side. It seemed to me it wasn't allowed, so it was very, very one-sided anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that's what John Hemming, MP, has said over and over again as well. There is just no chance of having a fair trial. The local authorities, there's no equality of arms, as one calls it. Mm-hmm. The local authority always have the deeper pockets. And in the end, the judges listen to them,
yeah,
and always would prefer their experts to be right than anybody else's. Now, the mother was prevented from being there because 9 police showed up without a warrant, without an arrest warrant, at her house. So that was, so, you know, she should have or could have, if she had known, made some kind of an application. But of course she by then had totally lost, as did Belinda McKenzie, faith in the judge delivering a fair trial. You see, what is it's very interesting that you compare with that case that you've just mentioned, because we've observed patterns over and over again, and one of them is obviously the gagging. Well, it so happens that Judge Powfley also got Belinda to do what I call a corporate gag. She got her to make an undertaking, to give an undertaking, that none of the members of the Association of McKenzie Friends would report on the case. Well, one of them immediately said, no way, and I can't what I said, but I did receive a an order, and in fact, that I had to appear before Judge Powfley, which I did, mm-hmm. and the order was obtained by the barrister of the Barnett Council talking to the judge privately, without
yeah.
the mother.
Yeah, this goes on.
And that is completely against all ethics of barristers
yeah.
and solicitors. And of course, it's such a minor battle then to fight. It's not worth fighting. And so in a way, I can understand the mother not having been there, but we've been begging her to instruct her, for her to instruct a solicitor who had come forward to in fact, defend me, but she just had lost too much faith in the whole system altogether.
When you hear statements like this, this is from Judge Powfley, she says there's no substance in the assertion that the mother has been prevented from participating at this hearing. If she'd been arrested on the 12th of February in connection with harassment allegations, the overwhelmingly likelihood is that she would have been released on bail, enabling her to come to court on the 17th of February. If she'd been remanded in custody, I would have been in contact with the police and prison authorities so as to make the appropriate arrangements for Mrs. Draper's attendance at court. Well, we've seen what's happened when someone's been arrested on these faked-up harassment charges. They end up in prison. They're totally abused. I'd put it to the fact that they're actually tortured, if you look at the case of Melanie Shaw. So there's no comfort in that drawn from Powfley at all, and it seems to be a protocol. She goes round on many of these cases, and to me she seems to be like a damage limitation operative on behalf of the judiciary.
Yes, I think so too. I mean, I in a way I was amazed that Belinda did give her the benefit of the doubt, but when I was before her, then she, at that point, she just kind of basically asked me to take down one or two items which were completely harmless, you know. I mean, one is completely ridiculous, in fact, because it was, I listed the case, which was Barnett versus Draper, and the council claimed that Draper would lead to the identification of the children. Completely pathetic, in other words. But in our position statement, we made it very clear. Either you return the children or we expose, more or less, you know. And so that's how the petition started. Now, that fact that then this spiteful work, as she recalled, it did, was completely unplanned, was completely unforeseeable, and completely uncontrollable. But no, the Barnett Council went as far as putting a chronology together and blamed anybody and everybody, and especially Ella and myself, for everything, which is just completely impossible. So I bothered to put in an application to set that order aside, but of course everything has now been, you like, wiped across by from the table with this fabulously published judgment
yeah.
with the title, which was released via the press association even before it was handed down in court, as some people spotted. You know, it was published by the Daily Mail and the Telegraph before it was handed down. But at least it speaks about satanic cult. I mean, that is, it has actually been a very significant line that so far hadn't been transgressed. There are oodles of people who deny satanic cults outright. They just don't want to believe it.
If they don't want to believe it, Sabine, then they have to ask the Metropolitan Police why they have a special satanic abuse unit. If it doesn't exist, why have the police got a special unit, satanic abuse unit? That's one thing, you know, that is one of the first questions I ask.
Well, look, can I interject here?
Yeah,
for a
sorry,
minute?
Tony.
I mean, you know, we were talking, weren't we, just before Sabine arrived. Hi, Sabine, by the way.
Hi, Johnny.
About Dennis Wheatley and his research into Satanism, black magic, this kind of thing, which he was doing back in the late 1920s, 1930s as a writer. And he makes it pretty clear in a book he's written, which is I think came out in about 1972 or something, called The Devil and All His Works, that most of this is done because, not because these people are any great believers in some kind of horned god or anything like that, but it's done to put the fear of God into the children. That really is about fear, and using fear to control, almost like a kind of sheepdog barking on the edge of a flock of sheep. This kind of thing is extremely powerful. And I'd also point to the particularly to Valerie Sinison, who I've interviewed, and her work in actually helping people who've been in these satanic abuse rings has been absolutely amazing, as far as I can see. And she has a complete and utter understanding of the way this is used to really hit psychological triggers at the earliest possible age in children, so that then they start to become utterly in fear and utterly obedient, and then they have a whole part of their personality where they have stuff going on in their lives, but that they know that they can't talk about it. So the whole thing is a kind of psychological trick, as far as I can see. And and I would send anybody, and I would point anybody who you know, has been poo-pooing this, for example Ian Hislop in Private Eye, despicably, who says that there's no such thing as this going on, and get them to have a chat to Valerie Sinison. You know, she's running a clinic which is NHS funded, which is government funded, for people who are in this, who have had this kind of abuse, and she's doing great work in actually giving people the confidence to go to court and do this kind of stuff. So, you know, for anybody to now say that satanic abuse doesn't exist is utterly ridiculous. It does, and it's used as a very, very powerful weapon through fear to control some of the most vulnerable people in our society.
Mm-hmm. It's the same line with paedophilia, isn't it? As we're learning that these intelligence services are involved in this, in particular throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, and up to the 90s. God knows what's going on today, but you know, maybe that's all to come out yet.
But in a way, I think the satanic abuse is a sort of paraphernalia that goes with the paedophilia in order to protect the people who are conducting it. You know, it's a sort of cover around the criminal acts in order to try and penetrate into the minds of the kids that, you know, the devil's going to come and get them if they breathe a word of it to anybody else.
But I mean, excuse me, Tony, I suppose you wouldn't have seen these videos, but it's not just the minds that are being penetrated, I'm afraid.
No.
The children dream too much, get injected. Just number wise, we are talking about 20 children and 70 abusers, roughly. Yeah. We don't know how many clients, but there is a great group called Hampstead Research now who are digging into the online presence and the connections amongst these abusers, whether it's Companies House, whether it's Facebook, whether it's tennis coaches, whether it's the parents, whether it's the churches, whether it's the teachers. And it's really a web and a net of abusers that is very, very dense and is quite far-leading. So now we've got the online community doing what the police should have done and doesn't do or hasn't done, because the cover-up is not only on the police level and not only on the court level and not only on the social services level, but also on the medical level. And the one big challenge is, of course, why are those whose distinguishing marks have been drawn by the children and very well described in detail, you know, in terms of tattoos and birthmarks around the genital areas of the abusers, why haven't these people been examined? So there are, besides the medical report, there is this particular aspect, and of course the whole principle of the retraction of the allegations
Sorry, Sabine, to interrupt.
It's obvious, but there's a cover-up to those who are willing and able to see. I don't think one needs to be biased, but it's also interesting that it's not as blatantly obvious as it is to me. So it's a very strange thing.
There is a big psychological aspect to this. I think you agree, Sabine, in a way it's a bit like Hitler's big lie, you know, the idea that you would do something so horrendous and so hideous just repels most people, yeah. even some police officers, mm-hmm. from actually even going there psychologically. It's like a kind of psychological barrier, in a way, for people to even consider that this is possible. And of course, again, the Saville thing has helped to actually smash through that barrier and to get more and more people, you know, millions of people across the country now, you know, consider this to be, well, we wouldn't say normal, obviously, but it's much more easy to consider something like this going on. The other thing I would say is I interviewed Stuart Siveray down in the Channel Islands in Jersey last summer, and he was absolutely adamant that this does go right to the top. It goes to the Queen, the Duke of Edinburgh, to the royal family, because they've made several appeals now with absolutely cast iron proof and evidence that the Queen's own personal appointees, officers in the Channel Islands, have been overseeing abuse, yeah. and they've been overseeing criminal misuse of sick and disabled people, putting them into solitary confinement, this kind of thing. I mean, really, the sort of stuff that you would maybe see in a medieval Hammer horror film going on right now in Jersey, and the turning of the head in the other direction as if nothing's going on. So actually, it would have been quite simple for Her Majesty to do something about this simply by reappointing somebody else in those key positions, the handful of key positions in the Channel Islands, and she's chosen not to do so. And I think you have to read that into that a pretty simple conclusion, which is that the royal family are actually aiding and abetting this criminality.
Well, let's look at Prince Charles and his relationship with Jimmy Savile. I mean, to hold keys to one of the most stronghold prisons we've got in the country, you know, that just doesn't happen by default, doesn't it? A DJ getting access like that to, was it a Category A prison? And then we look at the visits Savile made to the Channel Islands as well. You know, it seems to me that from the top level, the royal aspects of it all, there's a lot more to come out yet, Tony, and I think we'll find that Prince Charles, by putting himself patron of the Secret Services, there's probably a good reason for that.
Well, I'm very intrigued that you bring this up, Tony, and I would welcome your advice, because yesterday I was speaking to Susan Lindauer at length, and she kept saying, oh, I'm so glad that I'm not British, but she knows how the UK establishment works. And of course, I've seen on the Coleman Experience blog how, the entries on what he calls Filthy Britain, which is very, very explicit exactly about that aspect. But Susan, who is this extraordinary whistleblower in the US and who was involved in the Lockerbie bombing, as you mentioned, said that I should write to Her Majesty. And so what do I write? Because obviously she should protect the children. She should maybe appoint somebody other than the current minister to ensure that protection does happen, and not just the fake care system with taking 1,000 children a month. And they should maybe do a national inquiry also into current abuse and not just historic. I haven't had the right frame of mind yet to produce that letter, but ironically, a letter to Prince Charles gave me more hits than anything on my blog about the national inquiry, and that was written by Brian Peed, who is not only the survivor of abuse in a home, but also a whistleblower in Lambeth Council, which turned him into a victim of three police forces. And in my observation, the police are really more, if you like, criminal than anybody in this case. It's certainly the police.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
certainly
hang on a second,
the Metropolitan.
Yeah, because I mean, this announcement this week on Monday about the IPCC inquiry into Cyril Smith MP has actually really, I think, for the first time, really exposed the detail behind the criminality that was going on within the police, and also the fact that there were actually quite a lot of detectives that were absolutely disgusted by it and sick by it. So in a way, it does reflect back a bit on the discussion we were having earlier on about the BBC, where you've got many of these professional people are sitting in a kind of powerless position as they watch some of their colleagues, who seem to be being backed by their bosses, committing crimes day after day. Same within the police, same within the BBC. I mean, for example, evidence of witness testimony of senior politicians, senior civil servants being involved in child sexual abuse, simply being written out of statements, this kind of stuff. But ultimately, I think that there is going to be some kind of denouement here. And I would just say, if you're writing letters to anybody, I'm sure you're quite aware of this, Sabine, is always pick yourself three or four national newspaper editors and copy those them into those letters, because there's no point in writing to the criminals, is there? Particularly with the Princess Diana, there's quite clearly an involvement of the royal family at the senior level with the assassination of Diana, with this thing called I can't remember the name of it now. Way Ahead Group, that's it, as part of the royal family. It was a kind of subcommittee of the royal family that were looking for years at the problem of Diana, and then disbanded as soon as she was dead. So it's pretty obvious through John Morgan's work and his collecting together the evidence from the police inquiry in France, the police inquiry here in Britain, and the inquest that took place, three coroners and 10 years after the event, there's actually plenty of evidence that the royal family are right in the frame with the Diana assassination too. There's no point in writing to these people without copying them in. I mean, I actually spoke to a human rights activist, Liberty, the Origins of Liberty, the group Liberty that had a sort of little branch in the university here from the 1970s and 1980s, and they found the best tactic was to write to the local chief of police, copy it into the letters page of the local newspaper, and they get a reply straight back. I mean, if you've got a press which will report anything,
Booker?
You tend to get some results.
That's interesting.
How about
that's
Christopher Booker? Have you tried Christopher Booker?
Yes, of
Sabine?
Course. I hope at least he will feel sorry for me having to go into exile at some stage if he doesn't want to tackle Satanism.
But we've also got some brilliant MPs as well, Sabine, haven't we now? So we've got journalists, we've got MPs. You also, some of the most important work I think you've been doing is with the European Union's structures in this area. So, if you're going to send a letter, make sure you've got a sort of a basic little printout, mail merge or something, where you can click, 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 send it to those 50 other people. It simply won't be good enough for the Queen, Prince Charles, or whoever it is that gets the letter, to just simply put it in the bin, because it won't be in the bin in all those newspapers and MPs' in trays.
Okay.
Definitely agree. Okay. So one thing that's got me from this judgment was Pawfley's statement on saying that the clear message from recent events is that whilst Miss Draper is prepared to campaign using the internet, she's not willing to take part in this inquiry. But this stems back, doesn't it, from the intimidation process that whistleblowers seem to get from the beginning. And, nine police officers turning up at your doorstep. Luckily she had her legal counsel there at the time when they turned up, and he saw them off. They were there with even out of warrants. None of this was mentioned in that court case, wasn't it? The intimidation aspects.
Also the irony is Ella doesn't campaign herself at all.
No.
This is the accusation. They want to make her and me responsible. In fact, in that hearing on January 26, Pawfley dismissed her statement as saying that looks like it's having been penned by me, and she is too much under my influence.
Yeah, she seemed to concentrate very much on demonising the parents, Mr. Christie as well. She pulls to pieces the mobile phone recording by saying Mr. Christie is a directive towards the children, saying be quiet and go outside now, come on, hurry up, outside, 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 I don't play around, just stay there, that's it, that's right. that's right, discipline, he says. And a little later, sit around the table properly, son. Don't let me tell you again. You sit down properly, thank you. Well, these are sort of things that, you know, I mean, I've got an 8-year-old, and there are times when, you know, they can test your patience. And it's the sort of things that's said in, I'd say, near enough 90% of families in this country. She's played on this. She's played on this to make it sound like they're a controlling couple with their children. And I think this is a very dangerous trend to do in a court. So she's made sure that she, at every point, I mean, I've gone through this report, every page, I've highlighted bits where she seems to concentrate on doing her best to actually demonise the couple. Now, if they've not had a very proper investigation into this couple, then how has she come up, how has she drawn these conclusions? Just simply,
well, this is the terrible thing. I mean, for me, how to decide how to take this further, I've also had to think and think and think, but now I wanted to remind absolutely anybody and everybody that the children are the messengers, and they have conveyed the message. Ella and Abraham had to kind of digest the information themselves. They had to get it out of them. That is the great achievement of Abraham, that he got them to talk.
Yeah.
Ella had always only suffered from the bad experience. In fact, they had been to Tavistock, and now I've got a tweet from somebody who believes that Tavistock Institute runs the cult. I've always asked myself, who teaches the Father Dearman? Mm. Where does he know from how to run a satanic cult?
Tavistock obviously having deep roots in social engineering, as it were, or social psychology aspect of things. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. But one thing that really annoyed me here was when she stated that the ABE interviews on the 5th and the 11th of September are remarkable for a number of reasons, she says. Firstly, because the children describe a number of detailed allegations of ritualistic abuse. So she admits the fact that they're very detailed allegations. And second, because they do not articulately, with good eye contact or without trace of distress. Sorry, P can barely wait for the next question before she's chipping in with an answer. Both children are entirely matter of fact about what has happened. There's no trace of any emotional arousal. Well, obviously, she's contradicted what she says later in this document, because quite clearly, even children going through what they are, the allegations that they've made, can suffer from PTSD, which is signs of emotional detachment. And she's answering her own question here. Why are the children so matter-of-fact about it? Well, that's a symptom of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
It is, absolutely. And she clearly has no idea what the children have through, and she clearly doesn't sympathize or empathize with the children. And therefore, this whole charade of a family court that is supposed to find out what and act in the best interest of the children, it's just basically to A, the normal kind of snatching that goes on, and B, the handing over of the children to the abusive parent. And we've watched this pattern over and over again, and our next campaigning goal has to be to prevent the children from going to this father, and to somehow get a criminal court to listen on. And my submission to Brussels was I put in an emergency petition in the wake of the one on the about forced adoptions, that about the fact that secret family courts are used to cover up criminal activities, because her way of establishing facts to kind of then whitewash such criminal accusations, I mean, you cannot possibly derive justice from this.
No.
I mean, it's just so shocking in my view.
See, this isn't the first case that you've looked at, Sabine, isn't it? I mean, you've looked at multiple cases.
No, but it's the worst.
Sorry? It's the worst.
The worst?
Yeah, definitely the worst, because of the just the vast size of the cult aspect of it makes this worse. The harrowing thing as well is that them children can quite clearly and quite conversely put across their experiences, and well, what she's trying to turn that into now is that the parents have done this. This is what, without any investigation, because my understanding of it, that the police investigation was dropped quite soon.
Yes, 11 days after the children were taken. This is what I find so ridiculous. They focus absolutely on the mother and on the stepfather and forget about the message and don't listen to children. I mean, I've just found out today through a German press release that there is actually something in action now about the children in terms of the United Nations, that children are heard, can be heard, or and even be some kind of a class action, and I've called the Terre des Hommes about this, because we need to internationalize the whole thing in better ways and yes, go forward with the EU, where the Council of Europe is going to discuss the different levels of social services in April, and I'm curious whether the petition committee is going to talk about this particular emergency case as well. But there are so many fronts on which we need to fight. I've got one woman who's promised to write her response to this Pauvlied judgment in terms of jurisdiction as well as EU directive, because she was the one who also put this document together on which I based then the submission to Brussels, which is, according to EU directives, I have acted lawfully when I sent the link to the videos to the Home Secretary. I was following a lawful course of action to uncover crime. And so this lady, Deborah, she says, you know, I have acted lawfully, but the UK authorities have not. And in the process, I've discovered that, ironically, there has been an infringement notice issued to the UK in January 2014. The UK has then already violated an EU directive against, which was about child abuse and child abuse. So I haven't seen, I put in a Freedom of Information request to get that particular infringement notice, and I put some allies onto that track of trying to find out what are the procedures, what does one do with a naughty UK which infringes on EU directives and keep doing it again and keep doing it systematically. So there's a whole new battlefield that has opened now, I feel, thanks to the judgment and the challenge of the mainstream media, because the online community is certainly quite aroused, if you like, but it is not entirely convinced. There's lots of shills and hoaxes and trolls about. So it's a big, big, big job in terms of battle over the minds.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we can draw parallels here that, you know, within Europe, the UK is now getting quite clearly a bad reputation. We've had Putin speak up about the paedophilia rings here. We've quite recently, I think it was the Bulgarian Prime Minister who rebutted back at David Cameron. Something was brought up about the criminal aspects of immigrants coming here, and then the Bulgarian Prime Minister rebutted back by saying, well, at least we ain't full of paedophiles. So there is quite clearly throughout Europe a picture building up about our establishment and the paedophile connections that it's got, right down to through to child trafficking. What's your take on that, Tony, about our reputation abroad? I think we may have lost Tony there.
Well, I find it interesting that I didn't know that about this Bulgarian minister, because the last time I was officially in Brussels was because a Bulgarian mum was actually reporting about the forced adoption of her 2-year-old daughter, and it was a clearly paedophile father was involved, and I blogged about it saying we mobilized Bulgaria because she had got over 5,000 signatures together just in Bulgarian, and of course Bulgarian MEPs were very, very, very upset to hear about this. And, you know, initially the Slovak government, and then the Romanian government, and then the Latvian government has now written to the UK as well. So I think I hope in a way that this international embarrassment is going to have some kind of effect. But of course the UK always think they are the masters of it all.
Yeah, I think it was the Romanian Prime Minister, I think, who bit back. Look, with that.
One thing I would statement. Say, sorry about missing you, you know, I was just fiddling with Skype there, but I mean, I think Britain's reputation is not just in Europe, it's plummeting all over the world. And yeah. I mean, this doesn't sit very well, does it, with Britain's colonial past?
No.
Particularly. With the slave trade, I mean, I've been looking, for example, Bristol's role, the city I live in, is their role here in the colonisation of North America through Bristol merchants sending ships over. John Cabot was an Italian who was sent over from Bristol to do a kind of recce mission to Newfoundland and along the coast of North America, and then the ships that were then sent over after that to make initiate relations with the North American Indian tribes, who were then infiltrated, conned, murdered, assassinated, and then we had the beginning of one of the greatest genocides in the history of planet Earth, which was 75 million Native Americans murdered, yeah. And that was that
75
was
million.
That's the official figure. If you go and have a look by what the historians say, they reckon 75 million Native Americans were killed over hundreds of years. And I mean, this is what we've built the United States now on, the greatest genocide I think that has ever happened on the planet. Then after that, as if that wasn't enough, the Bristol merchants formed themselves into a formal organisation called the Merchant Venturers, which still exists today and run many of our National Health Service schools, hospitals. Even our mayor is a merchant venturer, or was a merchant venturer, and you know, that's basically the elite of the city. You know,
is that George? What's his name?
Rich and powerful. And what they did is they were people who financed the slave trade. For hundreds of years, rounding up black Africans in the Gambia and elsewhere, and then shipping them across at great profit to the Caribbean and to North America, and then bringing back sugar here to Britain. So, I mean, it's a particularly despicable trade in terms of, they reckon about 7 million of those Africans were died on what they called the Middle Passage, on the ships coming across from Africa to the Caribbean and part of the triangular trade, then the massive amounts of money was made here in Bristol, but no, very, very few, if any, of the slaves ever were seen here. So the whole thing was done as a kind of secret operation, with the crews being sworn to secrecy and not wanting to talk about it, and yet massive amounts of money being made by Bristol merchants in the process. So, you know, this doesn't sit very well, does it?
No.
Paedophilia and child abuse with Britain's colonial past. I mean, one good thing about you, I suppose you could say about it, is at least we pretty much divested ourselves of our empire. But then, of course, the IMF took over with their economic slavery.
Yeah, I just checked them figures about the Indian Holocaust. Yeah, it says here up to 100 million. That's incredible.
The Native Americans, yeah, and that was you know, John Cabot, and of course there were others from the Spanish side as well, but you know, and the Bristol merchants that kicked all that off. You know, North America had been discovered, of course, by the Vikings, etc., and they used to go over there fishing off Newfoundland, but this was not just about making contact. This was about enslaving, killing, and stealing the land. I mean, massive amount of land they stole as well.
50 shares of HSBC's tweeted in saying that this British imperialism sown the seeds for eugenics worldwide, really.
Well, but you see, in a way, you know, us Brits, we've got a sort of a little bit of a weight on our shoulders. But I think we've got the intellectual ability. We've got the confidence.
Do you think so today?
You know, we've got the tradition of freedom in this country in order to do something about it and actually come up with better ways of doing things. In fact, the responsibility for creating capitalism really rests with us. In the English Civil War back in the 1640s, there have been many capitalist city-states around the world, like, for example, Venice. You know, there were loads of them, run by merchants. But Britain was the first entire country to go over to being run by the merchant classes, kicking out the feudal, you know, chopping off the head of King Charles I, and then privatising the land in enclosure, kicking all the peasants off the land, getting them to work in factories, getting them to go abroad as soldiers. I mean, this way of kind of corralling the population was born here in Britain, and it's, you know, basically the birth of capitalism. So if we can start it here, we can also start the solution here.
Yeah, well, I think our chickens are coming home to roost, Tony, don't they? I mean, I don't think we can compare people today to the type of ethics that we had, or the great thinkers that we had of the past. Now it seems to be
Well, I think in a way we've got some brilliant activists today. You know,
oh, activists.
Just because we don't see them in the mainstream press or reflected in a lot of our, you know, national so-called media dialogue doesn't mean to say they don't exist, and they do. You know, there's lots going on in terms of activism, in terms of, you know, taking back control of public spaces, this sort of thing. And, you know, just thinking our way through to this kind of post-industrial world where, you know, many people, what they're doing is they're merging a lot of the best practices from the past, that is the sort of collectivism, working together with people, cooperation, with some of the best technology, grabbing that technology, not allowing it to be completely controlled by, you know, the old mill owners, the industrialists, and being creative with it. And I think, you know, Britain is definitely going to play an important part in the world we see, the post-industrial world, in the future. And definitely, you know, your control freaks, your Fourth Reich style, you know, industrialists that think they're running everything, and want to kick off a war with the Russians because they're so utterly morally bankrupt themselves. They want to distract attention from it. They've got a real, they're on a hiding to nothing, ultimately. And I think Britain's going to be a big part of the solution as we come to this sort of crisis, the crash, which is bound to come at some point. But it looks to me as if the criminal elite are trying to set up a situation where there will be some kind of conflict, you know, maybe with the Russians, maybe with the goodness knows where, but they will try to blame the crash when it comes. And I don't think people are going to buy it. They're going to try and blame it on the war, conflict, that sort of thing. But some of the public might buy it. But I think the majority of people are very wise to the fact that they're being run by a criminal elite. And so that just the fact that we've managed to raise the awareness there is going to mean certainly that it's not going to be so easy for these people to pull the wool over our eyes.
Going back to what you're doing in Europe and the EU, Sabine, what's the European, what's their attitude been to these allegations of the state child kidnapping, as you want to call it here in the UK? Because you put quite a strong case
as well. You know, you just can't believe it. I mean, and in Germany, recently I spoke also with somebody. It's our understanding of justice, you know, is just so different. They cannot imagine the kind of level of corruption that we have been experiencing. And it doesn't matter anybody, whether it's in Brussels, anywhere, anybody outside the UK just cannot grasp it and imagine it, that it can be as bad as it is. And I think this is so true for anybody who just hasn't been affected themselves. And in the Romanian, ironically, it's a solicitor whom I'm talking to over there. She says, in Brussels, she says, what has happened since communism came down, we now have a kind of a model for adoption that the UK should adopt. You know, I mean, isn't it bizarre?
It's just unbelievable. Yeah, it's, well, going back to this case, Sabine, you know, there's a few questions I want to put out here, and you know, because this judgment that she's made.
Listen, guys, just to say sorry, but I'm going to have to go now. But
yeah,
thank you ever so much for having me on. Any time, well, not totally any time, but always happy to oblige. Anything I can do to help?
That's great.
Share information, whatever. I'll just finally just plug the show I do, which is every Friday UK time, 5 till 7. We do a bit of politics, and we do a bit of real investigative journalism, I'd like to think. You know, we do a bit of engagement with national, international stories, and, you know, try and do radio the way it should be, in a way, a kind of public service. So thisweek.org.uk, and you can listen live online, or you can download our podcasts any other time. So hope you don't mind me doing a little plug at the
end. No problem at all,
Tony. Thanks so much for having me on.
And we're coming out, but he is afraid of a gate arrest.
Listen, it'd be great to catch up with Morris Kirk. You know, this is someone else that Sabine has put me in touch with. He's a really fantastic character, and certainly doesn't deserve to be behind bars. He's been bullied by the heavily Masonically infiltrated South Wales police. But anyway, that's another story.
That's another story for another day.
I'll say goodbye now. Thanks very much for having me.
Bye now.
That's
lovely
great. Tony,
to you again, Sabine.
Absolute pleasure.
Yes, I love this. It was a nice conversation. Very
cheers,
good.
Bye.
That's great. You take care. Thanks, Tony. That's Tony Gosling there from BCFM. As you say, you can get more details about his programmes and, of course, the archive stuff he's got there is really interesting listening to on thisweek.org.uk. If you want to check that out. Right, Sabine, getting back into the nitty-gritty of this judgment. There's so many contradictions when I actually read through this. Again, as she says, again and again, as I watch the interviews, this is the interviews at the police, I presume, from the 5th and 11th of September, my sense was that the children, for most part, were in the realms of fantasy. There was an urgency and excitement about what they were saying as the detail became more elaborate. There were obvious parallels in what P was saying, with some respect to the storyline being in C.S. Lewis's Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe. Now, this isn't the first time, isn't it, that we've had, you know, it being compared to a story or a film or a TV program. I think the last one, wasn't it, that actually came from the police or social services, is that it sounded like something out of Zorro.
Yes, The Mask of Zorro was quoted before by another case, I was told as well. I mean, it is just so bizarre that they come up with it instead of believing the victim. I mean, isn't it peculiar? First, men get killed in wars, then women who are victims of rape are not believed, and now children who are victim of child abuse are not believed. I mean, they are 8 and 9. Why should they not, and can't they believe? Why can't they? I mean, they could have even been asked to come to court for that matter, but of course it depends. They've clearly been so intimidated. You know, the body language in these retraction videos on the 17th, it is so obvious. There's a brilliant analysis on a blog called Crimes of Empire, where the blogger has analyzed that particular interview with the boy.
Yeah.
In extreme detail. And I just spoke to somebody this morning who's just done the same in parallel. She didn't know about that particular blog. And the way that this examining officer pushed the boy was clear as anything except achieving best evidence. So it's just really absolutely horrendous what these poor kids have had to go through, and we just must do our utmost to prevent them from being given to the father now. I mean, and what to do about this judgment? Okay, obviously we have got 21 days to file an appeal. And
is that going to happen, Sabine?
Yes, so yeah, we have to. I mean, we cannot just lean back and enjoy it. I mean, we must fight on all fronts, and so we need to tackle the council. I mean, I'm a big part of me is hoping the council will just like they did in Rotherham. I mean, it's just so impossible. In fact, I remember that there was also another case, a famous case with Barrister Michelle Friedman, who she, after all, fled as well to Israel with her to make sure that her daughters are safe. And that was the same council, and so I need to write to her again, because what on earth does one do with such a bad and corrupt council?
We were speaking not so long ago with Ian Josephs about that case as well, and many others. But you do get the same particular patterns coming out with these cases, and it's just horrifying seeing that the same sort of circuit judges in top high-profile cases seem to be drawn out, and you get the same sort of pattern as to how they conduct the case. I just want to focus now on this medical evidence. Paul Flea seems to be a bit deceptive on some of the medical evidence, and it's Dr. Hodes, wasn't it?
Yes.
She says that both children were examined on the 12th and 16th of September by Dr. Hodes. It was reported that P and Q had a number of scars and abrasions consistent with their assertions of being physically abused by Mr. Christie. Well, that's a leading aspect of it for a start.
Yes, it was for her to decide.
That's right. Well, she seems to have made a decision there on
exactly.
Well, she carries on to say the examination of P's perineal area was performed in the left lateral position as recommended by the Royal College of Paediatrics and the Child Health Review of March 2008. Dr. Hodes identified three linear scars extending almost to the anal verge as well as the anal laxity after 10 seconds of gentle buttock retraction. There was, she said, no reflex and dilation. The second examinations occurred on the 16th of September. Dr. Rhodes described more of the rationale for asking to re-examine the children's genital areas because she wanted to re-examine them. She said, I've got this allegation which has been made to several people. Dr. Hodes had thought about it over the weekend and on reflection believed she should have examined the children in the knee chest position, she added. It's not what you do, it's how you do it. Then on the 16th of September, each child provided Dr. Hodes with graphic details of how they were claimed to have been sexually abused, including the use of Vaseline on their bottoms and willies. They both said they'd experienced bleeding afterwards and that they said they were given wet tissue which to wipe themselves. Dr. Hodes' further genital examination of P revealed persistent reflex and dilation during buttock separation. The three linear healed scars were confirmed in relation to Q. Dr. Hodes confirms the physical findings of a scar in the anus from healed fissure consistent with infected injury from a blunt penetration force that he has alleged. Sorry, I'll carry on with this because we're going to get to an important part of this in a minute. Dr. Hodes wrote a further report on the 22nd of September, 5 days after the children had retracted their allegations. She repeated her physical findings and then comments upon the retraction in these terms. Until a study of 2007, it was mostly thought that the recantation rates were related to the certainty with which child sexual abuse is sustained and that the retraction of the true allegations is rare. And when a retraction occurs, it's likely to be false. Lindsay et al. Found a recantation rate of 16.9% in 257 cases of CSA. It relied on formal interviews by the police and social services. This is four times higher than previously reported in the most often cited Bradley and Wood case of 1996. In her concluding summary, Dr. Hodes states they have symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, I'm going back to where Porfley has said that the kids showed no emotion, you know, they seem to be very matter of the fact. Well, here we have the doctor's report saying that them kids have symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's her opinion that the extensive and detailed accounts given by both children, repeated to different professionals, contain details of sexual acts that young children would need to have had some sort of direct experience. Now, Porfley, it's a very long, you see, sometimes this is how it gets very misleading. There's 157 points, this, over multiple pages. It's not until you sit down and read this report, this judgment, that you actually think, well, hold up a minute, you're contradicting yourself there. Mm. You're making assumptions now. You're making a judgment, a professional judgment, and you're going against the actual medical evidence.
Yeah, one commentator said that she hopes that Dr. Hodes would now go against this, but I'm not sure whether that's who am I to know and find out, and I don't think at this point, but it is terrific. Also, I just know that the council, the Barnett Council, got a psychiatrist to actually denigrate the quality of this medical report. They just wanted to deny, effectively. I mean, cover up and deny, that's what the whole case is
about.
Goes
on, yeah, she goes on here, she questions the professionals, Judge Porfley. She says, I was troubled too that the children were subjected to intimate examinations to search for further signs twice in 5 days. I regret that Dr. Hodes was not asked exactly what she hoped to gain by the second examination, positioning the children differently. Seems to me that this doctor has stood out, and she's wanted to make her own, you know, professional, and let's face it, she's a paediatrician. It seems to me that Porfley's very upset that this doctor had tried to pursue this and is taking side with the children, as it were, and she's actually stated in the medical report that these children are obviously suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, but Porfley's not taking this on board at all. She's gone ahead and made this judgment, saying that the children were just very blasé about the whole thing. I just can't get that out of my head, how a judge, just a single judge, in what's turned out to be another secret court case without any representation on the other side at all, whilst we see up to 16 agencies supporting the local authorities' side of the case. It's just overlooking this evidence. I think it would be very sad if this judgment wasn't challenged in any way at all.
Well, no, it needs to be appealed, but that's not going to be our only strategy either. We will tackle the whole thing on a number of fronts, because the other kind of audacity that this woman had was she's more or less tried to tell the mother that she would handle the judicial review, which we filed in December against the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, and they, of course, denied the whole thing as well, and if that just now is waiting for anybody to pick up, so we need to run with that, and we need to run with the IPCC complaint as well, which Ella filed, because otherwise we couldn't have filed the judicial review, but that had been done as well. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the nice idea of private prosecutions, which I had already nearly 300 signatures for that. When both of my petitions were taken down, I don't know whether you were aware of that, but that's nice little interference by the powers that be. Supposedly because of the links to elements relating to court proceedings. Well, change.org claimed that they sent me an email, which they never did, because the only thing was they put up a notice in the help area where, you wouldn't believe it, but on the 4th of March, they claimed they did put it up, but I, on the 10th of March, asked the help center, listen, why have all those links disappeared from my petition? And they I can't remember the details they said. Anyway, they didn't know about that request on the 4th. And I only saw the request about the 4th after they had taken the whole petition down, and they claim it's not restorable. And now somebody else came up with a petition to ask to reinstate the petition or to give full reasons. So it's a new kind of a war
it's an attack,
internet
really.
Internet tools, isn't it funny in a way?
Yeah. I mean, we go on here, she sums up, says, there was no satanic or other cult at which babies were murdered and children were sexually abused. Well, I want to see the proof of that, because the police investigation was dropped rather quickly. I see parallels in a case that happened here in Weston-super-Mare with a local school, when a similar paedophile, the headmaster for that case is now serving 14 years. But I see exactly the same things happening with the school here that's happening in Hampstead, where, you know, they shut down the websites, there was a total ring fenced, and they actually ended up changing the name of the school. I understand that Hampstead, they've changed a lot of the staff there as well, which were named. But then she goes on to say, all the material promulgated by Miss Draper, now published on the internet, is nothing than utter nonsense. Well, we've heard this before, haven't we? Renowned by the paedophile protection people, David Cameron himself last year saying that this is all conspiracy theory, and Kenneth Clark saying silly stories from the 80s, nonsense. Well, we've heard that word nonsense, and they seem to utter nonsense a lot. But what seems to happen is, give it time, and these stories that turn out to be portrayed as being nonsense actually turn out being true. Look at the Dolphin Square incidents, look at the Elm Guest House incidents, look at the care home Nottingham, North Wales. We can go on and on and on, all labelled as nonsense, all labelled as conspiracy theories. Why isn't this any different?
Because it's conspiracy realism.
Yeah, and that's what we've got to start calling it now. She says the children's false stories came about as a result of a relentless emotional and psychological pressure, as well as significant physical abuse. Torture is the most accurate way to describe what was done. Now she again accuses Mr. Christie in collaboration with Ms. Draper. I want to see the evidence for that. Both children were assaulted by Mr. Christie by being hit with a metal spoon on multiple occasions over the head and legs, being pushed into walls, punched, pinched and kicked. Water was poured over them as they knelt semi-clothed. Well, you know, this really concerns me, how they've really turned this story a whole 180 degrees.
Yeah.
It's now within that short space of time that this hearing's been going on, that all of a sudden now, oh no, it's the parents that haven't been able to have representation of, and have had to flee. I emphasise the word had to flee for their own safety, and now just totally accused of the whole thing. And I just cannot see from that video, there was no hint to me that them children were being pressured in that sort of way.
They were definitely pressured by the guy on the 17th in the retraction interview. That's for sure. But and they were pressured also, by the way, to kill that Ella and Abraham. That came also out in conversations. But so there's Abraham says he's going to work on a statement. Ella has produced one which recently, because there were lots and lots of people who were asking and wanted to hear, and I think they are, well, it's a new phase that's starting now. It's a new round, but this document is certainly quite a bizarre statement of audacity. I think that it's in a way it reflects the same kind of arrogance that the sort of British Empire mindset still seems to have. She clearly thought that with that statement and with that with the mainstream, the general public. But I hope that the internet community is smart enough and that they are not the kind of mainstream media sheeple kind of readers, so that we will that she won't succeed in what she wants to do. But then it's not she who runs the show, it's the father. And that is the big question. How come he has so much clout that he does not only have influence over the judges, but even the police and everybody else who contributes? You know, it's quite remarkable.
Well, no one in their right mind, doesn't they, as a parent, would really put their children through what the judge is accusing them of doing. I really can't understand that. And just having seen that video, there was no indication there that the children were actually showing any sort of being scared or intimidated by the parents at the time. It seemed that they were glad to be talking about it and getting it off their chest. That's how it came across to me.
Yes, absolutely. And remember, after all, they had talked to Alan and Abraham for days already before they just made these little recordings here and there. So they are just snippets of reality after all. And I was mostly impressed by the utter consistency between the boy and the girl, and at different points in time, you know, and therefore then the retraction, they were just so obviously.
Well, the only intimidation I've seen was from one of the police interviews where that child, the boy, was left in that room for about 15-20 minutes and then he becomes scared. That to me is torture. That to me is intimidation. And that's the only evidence I've seen of any intimidation has come from the authorities. So, well, it's interesting. You'll have to keep us updated, Sabine, on how we're going to go forward with this and the appeal, or whether a private prosecution's going to take place. It's something.
Well, it's not an either or. I think we'll do both.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Well, we wish you all the best with that as well. And we're certainly going to keep looking at this case as well, because there's too many holes in it for me. That judgment, you know, I read it quite thoroughly a bit last night and this morning, and there's just so many contradictions in it, and there's so many allegations made by Paul Flea that have particular patterns that we've seen in other cases. It seems to me it's rolling off a script here. And the first thing you do is demonise either the family, the parents, or the extended family. That seems to be how they deal in with it. But, it's going to be interesting to see how this one develops.